Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows? You might just find your next favorite song.
Welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will explore the stories, traditions, and timeless melodies that have shaped our understanding of this art form. it's time for our weekly story. Imagine, it's a night in northern India. The sky is clear, the stars are sharp, and the air is still. Suddenly, from somewhere unseen, a single sound emerges. The low, breathy voice of the bansuri, or commonly known as the bamboo flute. The note bends gently, almost like moonlight slipping across water. It doesn't demand attention, no, it pulls you in. You can almost imagine the trees swaying a little closer, the air itself leaning forward to listen. For centuries, the sound of the flute has carried this reputation. It is not just music, but a force that blurs the line between human and nature. Indian classical musicians have long believed that a single song, played with sincerity, can awaken emotions, summon seasons, and change the very mood of the world around us. And to understand this, we need to talk about a central idea in Indian classical music, the ras. Ras literally means essence or flavor. It is the emotion that a piece of music is meant to awaken in its listener. There are rasas of longing, tranquility, devotion, heroism, love. Each song, the melodic framework of Indian classical music, or the rag, is designed to embody a particular ras. But it goes further. These songs are tied to the time of the day and even the season when they're sung. For example, Rag Bhairav, performed at dawn, is said to capture the awe and sincerity of the early morning. Rag Yaman, played in the evening, conveys calm devotion. Rag Megh is linked to the monsoon rains. Its notes are said to carry the scent of the wet earth. In this way, music isn't just entertainment, you know, it's a world of feeling. Once you step into, like, it's like walking into a dream where time, weather, and emotion, they all blur together. And before we carry on into our story, here is a song that highlights the bansuri or the bamboo flute. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Among the instruments of this tradition, the flute has always been special. Unlike the veena or the sitar, the flute is carved from a single piece of bamboo, so simple and yet capable of infinite expression. Its sound is the closest to the human breath, actually, and to hear the flute or the bansuri is to hear life itself carried through music. Stories about music's power often swirl around this humble instrument. Some are almost mythical. They say that when rag Megh Malhar is played with mastery, clouds gather and rain begins to fall. When rag Deepak is performed, lamps burst into flame. Musicians like Tansen, the legendary court singer of Emperor Akbar, were said to command these powers. He was challenged once to sing rag Deepak, the fire song, and his voice was so charged with energy that it actually lit lamps across his court and nearly burned him alive. And only the cooling rains of rag Megh, sung by another musician, could save him. Whether or not these stories are literally true, they do reveal something deeper, the belief that music is not passive. It acts, it changes, it transforms, and the flute, because of its intimacy with breath and silence, is at the heart of this enchantment. But melodies only have the spell. The other half is the rhythm. Indian classical music uses intricate rhythmic cycles, from the simple 8-beat teen tal to complex patterns of 11, 13, and even 16 beats. In a live performance, something magical happens. The audience begins to feel the cycle with the performer. People start nodding, clapping softly, or they start tapping their knees. They wait for that climactic moment when the improvisation resolves back to the sam, the first beat of the cycle. Imagine being in a mehfil, which is a small room filled with listeners. The air thick with incense and anticipation, and the bansuri or the bamboo flute weaves delicate phrases. The tabla answers, and suddenly the entire audience leans forward as one. The musician lands on the sam, perfectly timed, and the room erupts in joy. In that instant, community and music are indistinguishable. This tradition is ancient, but it is not frozen in time. Today, these songs echo in Bollywood soundtracks, in global fusion concerts, and even in pop songs touched by tabla and bansuri. The grammar of Indian classical, the rag, the rhythm, the melody, they have been adopted, reshaped, and even shared across the world now. Even here, thousands of kilometers from India, the sound of a single flute note can still hold a room in silence. And so, the enchantment of the flute continues. It is more than bamboo and breath. It is memory. It is mood. It's a myth. A single phrase in the right song can carry us to dawn, summon a storm, or open the quiet corners of our hearts. Whether it's a 15th century emperor court or a campus radio station in Kingston, this song still flows, timeless, borderless, and alive.
Thank you.
Up next on Melodies of Myth, we have a beautiful flute piece by one of Canada's finest. Before we listen, I want to introduce you to the artist behind the sound, Joanna Frohrer. Born in Vancouver, Joanna hails from a family of professional musicians. From early on, the flute wasn't just an instrument for her, it was her voice. She studied with Kathleen Rudolph in Vancouver, then went on to refine her artistry at McGill, working with Timothy Hutchins. At the age of 20, she was appointed principal flute of Canada's National Art Centre Orchestra, one of the youngest musicians ever to hold that position. And since then, she's performed as a soloist, chamber musician, and educator, with a repertoire ranging from Mozart's quartets to Rodrigo's flute concerti and beyond. She's also on faculty at both the University of Ottawa and McGill University, sharing her love for tone, phrasing, and musical color with the next generation. So here is her piece, bringing the artistry of the flute to life. Listen closely to how every note seems to float, to articulate not just melody, but emotion. Here is the next piece by Joanna Frohrer.
This is the sound of 100 children playing without a care in the world. Except for 12 of them. Because 12 of every 100 children live in poverty and are probably hungry. Let's make sure food banks are full for anyone who needs them. Just $16 donated to Feed Ontario can provide lunches for a hungry child for 1 month. Learn how you can help at feedontariotogether.ca.
And with that, our journey here today on Melodies of Myth comes to an end. I hope you all enjoyed and got to reflect back on these beautiful tunes and the sound of the flute. You've been listening to Melodies of Myth with me, Simmer Kaur, here on CFRC 101.9 FM, Queens Radio. Meet us back here every Friday at 3 p.m. for another journey into music and storytelling. Until then, take care, keep listening, and may you always find a little melody in your everyday life. See you next Friday at 3 p.m.
Mondays can be a tough day, but would you like something to brighten up your Monday afternoon? Well, tune in to my show, Dark Glasses, on CFRC 101.9. My name's Daniel Wolf, and the show is now in its 14th year with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
Welsh music, it's not just about harps and male-voiced choirs. Wales has a thriving contemporary music scene, and you can check it out here on CFRC. I'm Ed Reed, and every Monday evening at 8, also streaming online via cfrc.ca, you can listen to the best rock, pop, and traditional music on Cynan Cymraeg Heddiw, today's Welsh music, here on CFRC 101.9. Enjoy!
One day I got a letter from my two friends in Myrtle Beach saying they were going to publish a monthly newsletter because there were a lot of gays in the Air Corps, among the higher ranks as well as the PFCs and the privates. So they produced a newsletter which they called the Myrtle Beach Bitch. They wrote about who was going with who was sleeping with who. Her wartime coming out experience so radically changed her life that immediately after the war, she started the first lesbian newsletter in the United States, which she called Vice Versa. Unlike the Myrtle Beach Bitch, copies of Vice Versa still survive.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Burkina Faso outlaws queer sex. Pope Leo offers queer Catholics a Francis-like friendship. And Alan Barabé finds queer media pioneers in the U.S. military. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 6th, 2025. Burkina Faso is outlawing same-gender sex. The signature of military junta president Ibrahim Traoré is a foregone conclusion following the unanimous vote of the unelected 71-member transitional parliament. The ban on queer sex is a first for the Northwest African former French colony. Amendments to the Persons and Family Code passed on September 1st prohibit what Justice Minister Adaso Rodrigue Bayala called homosexuality or similar practices, as well as bizarre behavior. The punishment is up to 5 years in prison and fines of the equivalent of up to $17,800. Bayala also said that foreign repeat offenders would be deported. Amnesty International Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Marcel Siviud, welcomed some of the family code reforms. The minimum age for marriage is set at 18. Gender discrimination and inheritance rights is eliminated because consent between two parties is established as the basis of marriage. However, Siviud called the inclusion of the criminalization of same-gender sex alarming. He says that the ban violates the African Charter on Human and People's Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that the country has previously ratified. Human Rights Watch has also expressed concerns ever since the junta took power 3 years ago. The international organization charges the new government with what it calls serious abuses, further degrading the country's human rights and humanitarian situation. African LGBTQ activist, actor, playwright, and poet Frank Malaba finds it typical for a government he says is facing insecurity, poverty, and displacement due to conflict with armed groups to target LGBTQ people as scapegoats. Malaba says, today it's queer people. Tomorrow it could be women's rights, journalists, or dissenters. A government that dictates whom you can love will not stop there.
Pope Leo XIV intends to follow in his predecessor's footsteps when it comes to the queer community, according to Father James Martin. The New York Jesuit author, editor, and advocate had a 30-minute audience with the Pope at the Vatican on September 1st. Father Martin writes on his outreach blog, the message I received from him, loud and clear, was that he wanted to continue with the same approach that Pope Francis had advanced, which was one of openness and welcome. He described the pontiff as warm, relaxed, and serene, and funny. Recognizing that Leo's current priorities include major issues such as peace in Gaza, Ukraine, Myanmar, and other hotspots, Martin says he offered 5 steps for dioceses and parishes to take to welcome LGBTQ Catholics. He suggested that congregations can acknowledge their existence in the church, listen to their testimonies and needs, establish outreach efforts, include them in programs, and advocate for them when incidents of violence, bullying, and harassment occur. While some of the meeting was off the record, Father Martin could say, my overall sense is that he gets it and that he is ready to continue Francis's legacy of openness, and that is surely good news.
Moroccan feminist human rights activist Ibtisham Lashgar is heading to jail for more than 2 years for her Allah is Lesbian t-shirt. The Rabat primary court also imposed a fine equivalent of $5,500 for violations of the country's laws against blasphemy. Defense attorney Mohammed Khattab says an appeal is forthcoming to challenge the 30-month sentence handed down on September 3rd. Moroccan Association for Human Rights President Hakim Sukuk found the sentence shocking and called it an attack on free expression. The case has also drawn condemnation from several global human rights groups. Lashgar is a 50-year-old psychologist criminologist. Co-founder of the Alternative Movement for Individual Freedoms, she's well known in Morocco for her activism on behalf of the rights of women and LGBTQ people. She was arrested for offending Islam on August 10th, about a week and a half after she posted a picture of herself on social media wearing the Allah is Lesbian t-shirt. She's been behind bars ever since. Lashgar described the message on her t-shirt to one judge during the proceedings as a feminist slogan which has existed for years against ideologies and violence against women and has no connection to the Islamic faith. Lashgar is reportedly being treated for cancer and needs critical surgery on her left arm, but the judges have rejected repeated requests for temporary release. One of her attorneys told Morocco World News, she could die at any time in prison. We explained this to the court.
4 people arrested for attempting to restore the Rainbow Crosswalk near the Pulse Nightclub Memorial in Orlando were quickly released. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis wrote on social media, we will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes, and ordered all rainbow crosswalks in the state turned back to standard black and white markings. Cities are being threatened with the loss of state funding if they don't comply. Activists have been using chalk to restore the rainbow colors to the Pulse adjacent crosswalk ever since Trump administration officials ordered it painted over on August 20th. Some inscribed phrases like, right to free speech, you can't erase us, and love wins in spaces between the rainbow colors. Supportive protesters chanted, "Shame, shame, shame," as highway patrol officers arrested the chalkers. Some supporters then marched about a mile from the Pulse Memorial to Orlando City Hall and chalked rainbows outside the municipal building. A judge refused to pursue charges of criminal mischief and felonious interference with a traffic control device against the four who were detained. Despite the rain repeatedly washing away the chalked rainbows and the police posting warnings that read, "Defacing sidewalk prohibited," the protesters showed no signs of giving up.
Finally, world-famous diving champ Greg Louganis is taking the plunge on a journey of self-discovery. He's auctioned off three of his five Olympic medals, sold his Southern California home, parted with most of his possessions, and left the United States for Panama. A record-breaking Olympian from 1976 to 1988, Louganis publicly came out as gay in 1994 and announced that he was HIV positive in 1995. He wrote on Facebook that this new chapter in his life was motivated by the recent devastating fires in the Los Angeles area. In his words, "I had many friends, people I was close to, lost everything. I know I am choosing to do this, but their resilience is an inspiration for me to start anew with an open heart and an open door." At 65, he also admitted, "I needed the money. While many people may have built businesses and sold them for a profit, I had my medals, which I am grateful for. If I had proper management, I might not have been in that position, but what is done, live and learn." Louganis went on to explain his decision in Instagram live posts before and after his departure.
"Oftentimes, we don't realize how much we hang on to. You know, what I'm also learning now in this process is how much oftentimes we don't realize they weigh us down. Actually, I was discussing that with Michael Phelps, you know, because he heard I auctioned my medals. I said, how was that? I said, you know what? It was a relief. I made it to Panama City. I know a lot of friends are wondering. I lost my mind. Yeah, it's true. I probably did lose my mind, but trying to find it. I remember last year I was in Paris at the Olympics. It's like I didn't want to be here. Not that I didn't want to be in Paris. I didn't want to be on this earth. But now I'm realizing I have things to offer. What that is and what that looks like, I haven't figured it out. And I think that that's what this is kind of about."
Olympic diver Greg Louganis.
"I'm just embracing the I don't know and also staying open for discovery."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending September 6th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and myself, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Military personnel will have to shower with homosexual.
To accept the principle that homosexuals can't shower with other people is a degree of discrimination that goes far beyond this. I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
The year is 1948. The place, Singapore.
No perfume on guard duty. No drag on sentry go, eh? properly dressed, six bearers.
A story of how war can turn boys into men, and men into...
yeah.
Oh, yes, my bride. Pretty as a picture.
The obscure 1983 British dramedy Privates on Parade tells one story of World War II-era drag performers in the military. The late gay historian Alan Barrabay told another one. This Way Out's David Hunt recalls a presentation by Barrabay coincidentally around the same time that movie came out, and he was fascinated to learn that the modern queer press actually began with a couple of soldiers known for their hit drag shows in the early 1940s. It was 14 years ago this month that the U.S. government repealed its Don't Ask, Don't Tell prohibition against out active gay and lesbian service members. As we speak, transgender service members are being eliminated by the Trump administration, an administration also bent on erasing any trace of minority representation in history. So it's a fine time to document the legacy of LGBTQ plus people in the military and their role in building a foundation of queer journalism. Here's David Hunt.
There are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of news outlets serving the LGBTQ community around the world. From the Star Observer in Sydney, Australia, to QX Magazine in Stockholm, Sweden. Some, like The Advocate in the United States, have been around since before Stonewall. Most go back just a decade or two at most. There was a time, not that long ago, when the very idea of a newspaper or magazine for queer readers was unthinkable. It took a world war to change that. I'm David Hunt. In 1983, I met historian Alan Barrabay at the annual convention of the Gay and Lesbian Press Association in San Francisco. Barrabay was researching a book documenting the lives of gay and lesbian service members during the Second World War. That book, Coming Out Under Fire, would come out in 1990 and earn Barrabay a Lambda Literary Award. In his research, Barrabay interviewed scores of older gays and lesbians, leading to a startling discovery. The first queer publication in the U.S. wasn't one magazine, as widely believed. It was a gossipy newsletter published a decade earlier in the early 1940s by members of the U.S. Army stationed at an airfield in the Deep South. Barrabay recounted his findings in a presentation to the convention. Let's listen in.
In 1943, Norman, one of the men that I've interviewed, was sent to Hunter Field, an Army Air Force base near Savannah, Georgia, as part of the Special Services Unit there. Special Services put on entertainment for the troops. We are putting on a musical comedy, he remembers. During the rehearsals, they found out that there was a time slot that needed to be filled. Well, I had two buddies, and the three of us decided that we would do a comedy drag routine. So we got together a little skit and wrote a little song, and we did a dry run for the cast and crew when they really loved it. It broke them all. Next day, we went into downtown Savannah, and we walked into this dress shop and happened to find a woman there who was quite liberated for her time. We told her that we were doing the show, and could she contribute some dresses? Well, she was absolutely blown out of her mind to see three soldiers walk in and ask for dresses. But she was very cooperative, and she took us into the dressing room where we trod on a lot of gowns. And she gave them to us for free, for the war effort, she said. With the understanding that she and her husband could have complimentary tickets to attend the performance. Well, the first night of our show, light in the middle of our act and our song, there was a blackout, which happened in those days, and when the lights came back on, this bee that had a nest in the wings of the theater came out and stung me right on the nose, and I fell off the stage right into the lap of a colonel in the front row. Everybody thought it was part of the act, so we were asked to keep it in. Each night, we ended the act by coming out for an encore, and after the applause died down, we lifted our dresses and roller skated off the stage, just like Bea Lilly. She was a comedy singer at that time. From Hunter Field, I was transferred to Walterboro, South Carolina, and my two friends were transferred to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
One day, I got a letter from my two friends in Little Beach saying they were going to publish a monthly newsletter because there were a lot of gays in the Air Corps, among the higher ranks as well as the PFCs and the privates. So they produced a newsletter which they called the Moto Beach Bitch. They wrote about who was going with who was sleeping with who divorced each other and was going with someone else. And so the Moto Beach Bitch went on for quite some time, and it was almost like receiving a newsletter from home, because it was the only communication we had about people we had met in other bases, and it let us know who was overseas and where they were. It was just a mimeograph standard-sized piece of paper, and maybe it consisted of four or five sheets that were stapled together. And it was mailed to those people who were on the mailing list, and they in turn would give it to someone else, and if they wanted to be on the mailing list, they would just go ahead and send in their name. You see, people didn't save things in those days because we were all so afraid, not only of the service, but of our families. But people saved the Myrtle Beach Bitch. Well, what happened was the Myrtle Beach Bitch got into the hands of someone who turned it in. The two fellows who produced it had made the mistake of not camouflaging or changing the names. They just used the actual names. Well, there was a big purge. All the men whose names had appeared in the newsletter were called before the board, they were reviewed, and they were interrogated. There were hundreds involved. My two friends at Myrtle Beach were court-martialed and convicted for using the government mails to send vile and obscene materials. They were sentenced to 1 year and 1 month at Fort Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. My name also came up on the Myrtle Beach Bitch mailing list, and they called me in. They wanted to know if I had known any of these people. They had a whole list of a couple of hundred names of people that were in Savannah and people that were in South Carolina and people that were in North Carolina and even overseas, and they wanted to know how many I had had sexual contact with. I denied having sex with any of them because I didn't want to put anybody on the spot. They sent me to psychiatrists, and then they interrogated me, and then they put me in the hospital under observation in a locked prison ward with German prisoners of war. The next thing I remember, I was in J.C. Penney's, and they bought me a civilian suit because I was not allowed to wear the uniform, and they put me on a bus back home to New Jersey. And that was the end of my service. And that was the end of the Myrtle Beach Bitch.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. In a presentation to the Gay and Lesbian Press Association in 1983, historian Alan Barabay revealed how service members published what was likely the first gay newsletter in the U.S. during World War II. The first known lesbian newsletter was created a few years later. Barabay continues the story.
So at the end of World War II, a woman named Lisa Dan, that's her pseudonym, she rearranged the letters in the word lesbian to make the word Lisa Dan. Pretty ingenious. Toward the end of World War II, Lisa Dan left her parents' home in a small Northern California town up here and took a bus down to Los Angeles to find secretarial work in the movie studios there. She moved into a women's boarding house, where she met other gay women for the first time. They lived on the floor above her. They introduced her to lesbian social life by taking her to women's softball games and dancing at the IP Club, a lesbian bar in Los Angeles. Her wartime coming out experience so radically changed her life that immediately after the war, she started the first lesbian newsletter in the United States, which she called Vice Versa. A few years ago, Lisa Ben described to Leland Moss, a writer for Gays Week in New York, how she started up her little magazine in 1947. I had a lot of time to myself when I was secretary in the movie studio, she recalled, and the boss was at a lot, so I decided I would make up a little magazine to wire away the time. I thought I'd make up a gay magazine because I had never seen any on the newsstands. I thought it would be great if it were a real magazine with a printing press and all that, but I couldn't do that, so I typed it out in a typewriter. In those days, we didn't have Xerox machines, so I typed six copies at a time, five carbons and one original. I typed the whole magazine page by page, then I'd begin over again and type six more, so that each printing there were only 12 copies, which made it a darned exclusive magazine. I didn't really want it to be that exclusive, but I had no other recourse.
There would be a preamble, a movie review. There were very few movies that dealt with that subject in those days, but even if there was one that only hinted at it, I would plow it up. And I'd write poetry and maybe a short story. I would entreat my readers to send in articles and stories too, because I wasn't that prolific, and I felt like I would run out after a while, if not of time and opportunity, then of my materials. So a few girls sent in some poems and some little items of this and that, but they didn't really get into it, and I wish they had. It was a very slim magazine, maybe about 9 pages in one, 16 in the next. But the reason it was so slim was that it was so very hard to turn it out. And that if anybody came around, I had to zip it into my briefcase quick on my desk drawer. But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I would give it away to my friends. There was one stipulation. I didn't want to make money off it. I just wanted to give it away. I had no idea how daring or dangerous this was. I used to mull them blithely out from the place where I worked until somebody said, don't you know you could get in trouble for mailing this? I didn't know why. There were no four-letter words or pictures in it, nothing that could be misconstrued as something sexual. I didn't name the names of places where people congregated, but they said, we're telling you for your own good, you'd better not do that anymore. So I took their advice and distributed them personally, and I'd say, when you're through with it, pass it on, because there aren't that many of them, and I'd like to get them to as many people as I can. So that was the story about my gay magazine, Vice Versa, and it went on for 9 months. Unlike the Myrtle Beach Bitch, copies of Vice Versa still survive. And I have a Xerox copy of one of them here if you want to look at it later. The first issue, which Lisa Ben typed up for distribution in June of 1947, began with this explanation. Have you ever stopped to enumerate the many different publications to be found on the average newsstand? Yet there is one kind of publication which has never appeared on the stands. Newsstands carrying the crudest kind of magazines appealing to the vulgar would find themselves severely censured were they to display this utter type of publication. Why? Because society decrees it thus. Hence the appearance of Vice Versa, a magazine dedicated, in all seriousness, to those of us who will never quite be able to adapt ourselves to the iron-bound rules of convention. A few issues later, in response to a reader's letter praising the magazine, Lisa Ben wrote, "Your letter is very flattering. I have never considered Vice Versa as a courageous venture. I believe that there is a definite need for such a magazine among the gay folk. Vice Versa was long a fond dream of mine ere it came into reality in June 1947. It is my personal contribution to others of my ilk, meant to provide an outlet for the creative self-expression so often of necessity pent up within us." And finally, in an article entitled Here to Stay, Lisa Ben reveals her dream for the future. "Whether the unsympathetic majority approves or not, it looks as though the third sex is here to stay. Nightclubs featuring male and female impersonators are becoming increasingly prevalent. Even cafes and drive-ins intended for the average customer, when repeatedly patronized by inverts, tend to reflect a gay atmosphere. Books such as Diana and The Wall of Loneliness are now available at bookmarts and even drugstores. With such knowledge being disseminated through fact and fiction to the public, homosexuality is becoming less and less a taboo subject, and although still considered by the public as contemptible, I venture to predict that there will be a time in the future when gay folk will be accepted as part of regular society. Perhaps even Vice Versa might be the forerunner of better magazines dedicated to the third sex, which in some future time might take their rightful place on the newsstands beside other publications to be available openly and without restriction to those who wish to read them."
You've been listening to a 1983 recording of historian Alan Barabay, author of Coming Out Under Fire, discussing the first LGBTQ newsletters in the U.S., the forerunners of today's queer media. Sadly, Barabay died in 2007. I'd like to thank the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California for preserving this recording. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thank you for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Lucia Chappell and Michael LeBeau and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. The Zombies, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Barbara Streisand, Adam Dibb, and Anthony Lazzaro performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton, celebrating their 50th year together, Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KHEN, Salida, Colorado, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, BridgeRadioPA.com, Perth Andover, New Brunswick, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now